welcome to Notable Nobels, a podcast about the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine. My name is Harrison Doolin. I'm a postdoctoral scientist at the Fred Hutch Cancer Center in Seattle, and I will be your host for this web series. Now, the purpose of this series is to trace key advancements made in the biological and medical sciences over the past 120 years or so, and we're using the Nobel Prizes in Physiology or Medicine as a guide. Now, every career has its highest prize, and for scientists, that prize is the Nobel Prize. It's the most prestigious award a scientist can receive, and it marks discoveries that have made a profound impact on our understanding of biology and our ability to treat diseases. Today, we will be examining the 2020 Prize in Physiology or Medicine, which was awarded to Harvey J. Alter, Michael Houghton, and Charles M. Rice. The Nobel Assembly at the Karolinska Institute chose to give Alter, Houghton, and Rice the award, quote, for the discovery of hepatitis C virus, unquote. We'll be going over the realization that another hepatitis virus existed other than hepatitis A and B viruses. We'll be going over the experiments undertaken that led to the identification of the hepatitis C virus, and we'll talk about how hepatitis C went from being a highly deadly disease to being highly curable. But first, a little bit of background on our Nobel laureates, and we'll start with Alter. Harvey J. Alter was born in New York City in 1935 to Jewish parents. His father was a businessman, but he impressed upon his son the importance of the medical sciences. Alter attended the University of Rochester in New York, earning his bachelor's degree in 1956, after which he stayed on at the university's medical school, earning his medical degree in 1960. He wasn't particularly interested in medical research, but that changed in 1961 when he received word that he had been drafted into the United States military. Drafted doctors had the option of fulfilling their military service as clinical associates at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland. Alter was accepted into the NIH's program, where he got his first exposure to medical research. He ended up working with Baruch S. Blumberg, studying blood proteins, and Alter was one of the lab members who first identified the AU protein that later was recognized as the hepatitis B virus surface protein. When Blumberg moved his lab to Philadelphia, he asked Alter to join him, but Alter declined, choosing instead to complete his clinical training. He accepted a position as a clinical hematology fellow at Georgetown University Hospital in Washington, D.C. He writes that while he was there, he spent, quote, 50% of my time teaching, 50% seeing patients, and the other 50% doing research. I was spread very thin, and my math wasn't very good either, unquote. He stayed at Georgetown until 1969, when he was offered a position back at the NIH to work on transfusion-associated hepatitis. He accepted the position and remained at the NIH for the rest of his career. One of the first things Alter did in his new position at the NIH was help set up the testing of donated blood for hepatitis B virus. The testing was being rolled out across the country, and like other blood banks and hospitals, the NIH saw a steep decrease in post-transfusion hepatitis cases after the testing was implemented. But transfusion-associated hepatitis cases never dropped to zero. About 5-10% of blood transfusion recipients were still developing hepatitis. Many of the patients developed chronic hepatitis, which in some cases would result in liver complications, including liver cancer and liver scarring, both of which could be fatal. Alter's lab began keeping a stash of blood samples that were linked to transfusion hepatitis but were negative for hepatitis B. In 1975, another lab at the NIH reported the discovery of the hepatitis A virus, which is spread in contaminated food and water. Alter's lab went back to their stash of blood samples and tested them for the newly identified hepatitis A virus, but all the samples were negative. Disappointed but undaunted, Alter decided to show experimentally that there was a transmissible agent in the blood that was causing these remaining hepatitis cases. He took his blood samples that were negative for both hepatitis A and B viruses and injected 5 chimpanzees with the samples. All 5 chimps developed hepatitis. Alter and his colleagues decided to call this new form of hepatitis simply non-A, non-B hepatitis. They debated calling it hepatitis C virus at the time, but in the end decided against it because they still didn't know if the infectious agent was really a virus or if it was caused by a single pathogen or multiple pathogens. So non-A, non-B hepatitis was the name for this suspected pathogen, and Alter and others began trying to identify it. If they thought at first it would be easy, well, they were mistaken. 13 years after Alter first coined the term non-A, non-B hepatitis, the pathogen had still not been identified. Alter, in a bit of literary flair, vented his frustration in a poem he wrote in 1988, and here it is. Quote, "I think that I shall never see this virus called non-A, non-B. A virus I cannot deliver, and yet I know it's in the liver. A virus that we often blame, but which exists alone by name. No antigen or DNA, no little test to mark its way. A virus which in our confusion has forced us into mass collusion to make exist just by exclusion, but is it real or an illusion?" Unquote. Now, he didn't know it at the time, but Alter was less than a year away from finding out the answer to his quest. But it would not be his group that finally identified the virus. That discovery would come from a biotech company out in California and a group that included our second Hep C Nobel laureate, Michael Houghton. Michael Houghton was born in 1949 in Great Britain to working-class parents and grew up in London. He earned an undergrad degree in biological sciences from the University of East Anglia in 1972. He then returned to London to attend graduate school at King's College. He was already interested in virology, and his graduate work focused on immune responses to viral infections. Houghton graduated with his PhD in biochemistry from King's College in 1977, after which he emigrated to the United States. In 1982, he joined the recently established Chiron Corporation, a biotech company based in California that would later be acquired by the pharmaceutical company Novartis. It was at Chiron that Houghton would make his Nobel Prize-winning discovery. One of the first things Houghton's group tried to do was grow the non-A, non-B hepatitis virus in cell cultures. They knew it would be much easier to isolate the virus if they could grow it in a layer of cells rather than in a person or an animal. However, despite years of effort, neither they nor anyone else was able to grow the virus in cell cultures. That left them with trying to identify the virus from samples taken from infected humans and chimpanzees. The first test they tried was to probe infected specimens with DNA probes made from known viruses. The reasoning was that if the unknown virus was similar enough to a known virus, the probes would bind and the scientists would be able to isolate the virus genome. However, though they tested a wide range of viruses, their probes didn't work. They also tried scanning infected samples with an electron microscope to try to visualize the virus, but that didn't work either. Additionally, they took sera from patients who developed non-A, non-B hepatitis and used the antibodies in the sera as probes to try to stain for virus in tissue samples. This method also failed to identify the virus. After years and years of failure, Houghton then decided to do something very clever. His team speculated that the reason the attempts to isolate the unknown hepatitis virus had failed was because the tests were not sensitive enough. In other words, the virus was not pure enough or abundant enough in their samples to be detected with the tools they had been using. Ideally, if they could figure out a way to grow the virus in cell culture, then they should be able to get enough pure virus to detect with their methods. The problem was they couldn't get the virus to grow in cell culture. Houghton then devised an experiment that would get around this problem. Rather than try to get the full hepatitis virus to grow in cell culture, he decided to take pieces of the virus genome and stuck those pieces into another virus that would grow in cell culture. The piece of the virus that Houghton aimed to isolate was RNA. He purified all the RNA from sera that came from an infected chimpanzee, and then using the reverse transcriptase enzyme discovered by David Baltimore, he converted that RNA to DNA and inserted the DNA copy into a virus called a bacteriophage. Bacteriophages are viruses that infect bacteria. Scientists had worked out ways to insert DNA into phages so they could express the new DNA in bacteria. By using the phages and the bacteria to express the genes derived from the hepatitis virus, Houghton reasoned that the bacteria should be able to make enough pure virus protein to be detected with the antibodies in patient sera. Now that sounds really good, but the test was still a long shot. The RNA Houghton isolated from the chimpanzee sera contained not only hepatitis viral RNA, but also a ton of RNA from the chimpanzees. This meant that most of his phages were given chimpanzee genes, not viral genes, and if Houghton hoped to find the hepatitis virus, he would have to test literally thousands of bacteria colonies for the virus protein. It would be like finding a needle in a haystack, but Houghton decided to run the experiment anyways. Thousands of colonies later, his team finally found their needle. A single colony of bacteria reacted to the antibodies from an infected hepatitis patient. Excited, Houghton's team contacted Alter over at the NIH. Houghton's team wanted to use Alter's stash of blood samples to confirm that they really had identified the virus. Alter sent Houghton's team a panel of sera as a test. The panel contained blood from both hepatitis patients and healthy controls, but as part of the test, Alter did not tell Houghton's team which blood samples were from which patients. If Houghton's team really had identified a component of the long-sought-for hepatitis virus, then the sera from the infected patients would react with the viral protein, and Houghton's team would be able to tell Alter which blood samples were from hepatitis patients and which were from normal patients. Houghton's team ran the test and quickly sent their results back to Alter, asking him to confirm if they had correctly matched the blood samples. Alter didn't reply immediately. This was the 20th time his blood panel had been used to verify a claim for the discovery of the missing hepatitis virus, and all the other 19 claims had failed the test. So he wasn't expecting much from Houghton's group. But when Alter did get around to checking their results, he was surprised to see that they had correctly identified every sample. Houghton's team had finally found a gene from the missing hepatitis virus, which was eventually renamed the hepatitis C virus. Houghton's team published their findings in the journal Science in 1989, and the news quickly spread to the scientific community. Many people were convinced that the newly isolated virus was indeed responsible for the remaining post-transfusion hepatitis cases. This claim was further supported by the clinical results observed after blood banks began testing for hepatitis C virus, using the viral proteins identified by Houghton's group and others. Within a decade after the screening for HCV was introduced, post-transfusion hepatitis cases fell to practically zero. This was a major step forward clinically, but for the scientific purists out there, a problem persisted. Houghton's identification of the hepatitis C virus established a very strong correlation between hepatitis cases and the presence of the virus, but as scientists are fond of saying, correlation does not equal causation. Some people still wondered if the virus really was causing hepatitis, or if it was simply associated with the disease. To address this concern, we now turn our attention to our third Nobel laureate, Charles M. Rice. Charles Rice was born in Sacramento, California in 1952. Like Alter and Houghton, he didn't have a family background in the sciences. His father was an insurance agent and his mother was a housewife. But Rice became interested in the biological sciences at an early age. He was initially thinking of going to veterinary school, but became interested in scientific research during his undergrad training. He graduated with a bachelor's degree in zoology from the University of California, Davis in 1974. He then enrolled in a graduate program in biochemistry at the California Institute of Technology. Rice had picked up an interest in virology and joined the laboratory of Dr. James Strauss, who was studying the molecular biology of viruses with RNA genomes. Rice earned his PhD in biochemistry from Caltech in 1981 and then stayed on with Strauss as a postdoctoral scientist. His research at Caltech focused on sequencing the genomes of different RNA viruses, and he helped produce a system for producing viral RNAs from DNA. In 1986, he was offered the opportunity to set up his own lab at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis. It was in St. Louis that Rice would make his Nobel Prize-worthy discovery. In 1989, not long after Rice arrived in St. Louis, Houghton's group published their isolation of the hepatitis C virus genome. This was big news in the virology field, and it caught Rice's attention, particularly the finding that hepatitis C virus had an RNA genome and was a member of a family of viruses called flaviviruses. Rice had been working on flaviviruses since his graduate school training, so the finding that hepatitis C virus was also a flavivirus piqued his interest. As already mentioned, scientists were having a very difficult time growing hepatitis C virus in cell culture and purifying the virus from infected animals. This meant that it was difficult to obtain a pure virus culture that researchers could be sure contained only the HCV virus and nothing else. But the identification of the virus genome by Houghton's team would change that. By the 1990s, molecular biology techniques had progressed enough to allow researchers to make complete DNA copies of RNA virus genomes. The DNA copies could then be used to create pure viral RNAs, which could then be used to create infectious viruses if inserted into the correct cell type. So even if scientists couldn't purify the hepatitis C virus, they could get pure copies of hepatitis C virus RNA. Several teams of scientists, including Rice, had made DNA copies of hepatitis C and obtained pure RNA copies of hepatitis C virus genomes. They then tried to use the RNAs to produce virus in permissible cells. Rice's team specifically was using chimpanzees, which are the only animals other than humans that can naturally be infected with hepatitis C virus. However, the RNAs Rice used didn't produce any infectious HCV. Rice took this to mean that there was a problem with the RNA sequence. Sure enough, when Rice checked the published reference sequences of HCV, he found multiple mutations in each sequence. Rice reasoned that by making an RNA that contained the most common sequences found in HCV, which is called a consensus sequence, they would be able to create the most likely RNA capable of infecting cells. Rice followed up with his idea and inoculated two chimpanzees with RNA containing a consensus sequence from the HCV genome. 10 weeks after injection of RNA into the liver, both chimps had high levels of hepatitis C virus and were clearly suffering from liver damage and hepatitis symptoms. This was proof that hepatitis C virus wasn't just correlated with hepatitis, it actually caused hepatitis. Rice published the results in 1997 in the journal Science, and the results were greatly appreciated by the scientific community. But now, you might be saying to yourself, wait a minute, he published his results back in 1997? I thought this episode was about the 2020 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine. Why was there a gap of over 2 decades from when the final results were published and when the prize was awarded? Well, that's a good question. And unfortunately, we can't say for sure, since the nomination and decision-making process for the Nobel Prize is kept a secret for 50 years from the year of the award. However, one possible reason it took so long for Alter, Houghton, and Rice to be awarded the Nobel Prize was because there was a rather long gap between their initial findings about hepatitis C and clinical benefits for hepatitis C patients. This brings us to our final topic of this episode, how we can treat and prevent hepatitis C virus infections. As the American politician Benjamin Franklin once wisely said, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. As mentioned earlier on this podcast, one of the first steps clinicians took after the identification of hepatitis C virus was to prevent post-transfusion hepatitis C cases. By removing donated blood that was positive for HCV, hepatitis C cases from blood transfusions basically disappeared. But there are ways of acquiring hepatitis C other than from blood transfusion. In the United States, hepatitis C is spread primarily among users of intravenous drugs, and the recent opioid epidemic has driven an increase of Hep C cases in the US since 2010. Additional routes of transmission include exposure to the blood of an infected person, usually someone who is a close regular contact like a relative, and less frequently, through sexual transmission. These methods of spread suggest that Hep C cases could be curtailed through changes in human behavior, such as stopping needle sharing between users of intravenous drugs, but the main mode of prevention scientists wanted was a highly effective vaccine against HCV. In the last episode of this podcast about Hep B, we mentioned that an effective vaccine was produced almost immediately after Hep B was identified. But this was in part because a method existed to purify the hepatitis B virus protein from human blood, which could then be inactivated and used as a vaccine. As mentioned earlier on this episode, scientists were having a difficult time purifying the hepatitis C virus proteins. Now, this became easier with the development of molecular biology techniques in the 80s and 90s, but there were still additional challenges. A big one was the genetic diversity of the hepatitis C virus. As scientists began to take advantage of new sequencing technologies, they realized that hepatitis C virus has a high amount of genetic diversity. Hepatitis C virus has an RNA genome, and RNA viruses, which include the other flaviviruses, influenza viruses, HIV, and the coronaviruses, these RNA viruses tend to mutate at much higher rates than DNA viruses like, say, hepatitis B. Hepatitis C viruses can be grouped into 8 different genotypes and over 100 different subtypes. Creating a vaccine that works against all the different types of HCV is a major challenge. Not only that, when scientists compared the hepatitis viruses, they found that the proportion of adults who develop a chronic infection after getting HCV is way higher than adults who get infected with HBV. While only about 5% of adults who get infected with HBV develop a chronic infection, 70% of adults exposed to HCV develop a chronic infection, and this is where the virus does not get cleared from the body. About a third of those chronically infected patients will go on to develop liver scarring or liver cancer, and globally, there are about 400,000 deaths each year from chronic hep C. Preventing chronic hep C infections with a vaccine remains a challenge in part because the virus is really good at establishing a chronic infection. Finally, another problem with making a hep C vaccine is that testing HCV vaccines is currently rather difficult. The only animals that naturally support the replication of hepatitis C virus other than humans are chimpanzees, and these animals have been phased out of research in recent years. The lack of a good animal model for hepatitis C research slows down the ability of researchers to do preclinical testing of vaccines to know if the vaccines will work in animals. Despite all these challenges, people have nevertheless carried out HCV vaccine trials, though most never made it very far. In fact, only one phase 2 clinical trial of an HCV vaccine has been carried out, and that was in 2021. The trial enrolled over 500 participants, and the results were published in the New England Journal of Medicine. Unfortunately, the vaccine did not protect against the development of chronic hep C. Now, while work on an effective HCV vaccine continues, it's unlikely to come anytime soon. So, in the absence of a vaccine to prevent chronic hep C, how about we go for a cure? Now, here's where things get a lot more positive. On this podcast, we've covered a number of viruses that can cause persistent or chronic infections, including HIV, human papillomaviruses, and hepatitis B virus. However, hepatitis C virus is the only persistent viral infection that can be reliably cured. This is a very cool and fairly recent development, and it's possible because HCV has an RNA genome. HIV, HPV, and HBV all have DNA copies of their genomes that persist in infected cells, whereas HCV is exclusively an RNA virus. RNA is a much less stable molecule compared to DNA, and this makes HCV much more susceptible to antiviral drugs. The development and use of antiviral drugs against HCV began in the 1980s with a drug called interferon. Interferon is a naturally occurring molecule produced by your cells in response to infection, and it stimulates the immune system to fight pathogens. Treating patients with interferon could cure hep C about 20% of the time, a really low percent, and those cures sometimes required treatments lasting over a year, which many people found difficult because of the side effects of the drug. Then in 2001, the first change in HCV therapy came with the introduction of ribavirin, a drug that could inhibit viral RNA synthesis. By combining interferon with ribavirin, cure rates rose to about 50%, though the side effects of interferon were still a problem, and the treatments lasted about 6 months. Then a breakthrough came in 2011 with the introduction of an entirely new class of anti-HCV drugs called protease inhibitors. As the name states, these drugs inhibited a viral protein called a protease, and the protease is essential for viral replication. Combining a protease inhibitor with ribavirin and interferon increased cure rates to about 80%. A year later, another group of antiviral drugs was released that targeted a separate viral protein called NS5A, which is also necessary for viral replication. In 2012, researchers showed that a combination of a protease inhibitor drug with an NS5A inhibitor drug was sufficient to cure over 90% of patients without the need for interferon, and cures could be achieved in as little as 8 to 12 weeks. Updated versions of the original protease inhibitors and NS5A drugs have since been released, and now 98% of chronic Hep C cases can be cured with a 12-week course of antiviral drugs, with minimal side effects. This amazing accomplishment caught the attention of the Nobel Committee, and in 2020, in recognition of the initial work that made all the cures possible, they awarded Alter, Houghton, and Rice the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine. So what's next for hepatitis C virus? Well, the WHO, the World Health Organization, has set a goal of reducing 90% of new hepatitis C virus infections by 2030. This is an ambitious goal, considering we don't have a vaccine, but it's not an improbable goal. However, I'm skeptical it will be achieved so soon, especially with the recent increases in HCV here in the United States. Also, even though we have great diagnostic tools and amazing antiviral drugs for HCV, a big challenge right now is getting people access to those treatments. Great tools and great drugs are useless if you can't get them to the people who need them. Discouragingly, a 2022 paper estimates that only about 8 to 10% of people with chronic HCV infections are likely to be cured, despite the drugs working 98% of the time. And this is simply because they either won't be diagnosed or can't get access to antiviral drugs. So broader strategies to facilitate better access to diagnostics and antiviral drugs will be important as we aim for the in principle achievable goal of global eradication of hepatitis C virus. That concludes this episode of Notable Nobels. This episode was recorded on October 28th, 2023. I want to thank Digital Mind Productions for providing the music, and thanks to Nicholas Wynn for doing the graphic design for the logo. Now for next time, I made a recent adjustment to the schedule because a few weeks ago, this year's winners of the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine were announced, and it fits in perfectly with my current focus on Nobel Prizes related to infectious diseases. So that is all I'm going to say about that for now. But want to know more? Well, listen next time to find out. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you then.